TheBook.com.
Well, once again, everybody, thank you for joining me here on this Friday, July 1st edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We'll go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting standpoint. Happy to have you with me here to wrap up this week of Bang the Book Radio and kick off the month of July. It's going to be a little bit different of a month here on Bang the Book Radio. Want to make sure that I get this out there. Don't want anyone to be caught off or caught by surprise. But we're going to be doing a different format here in the month of July. Again, remember, no shows during the week of the All-Star break, July 11th to July 15th. If you want to get in touch with me, reach out on Twitter, at Skating Tripods. You can also send us a Facebook message to our Bang the Book page. But in terms of Bang the Book Radio, we're going to be doing the Bettors Box. It's my MLB betting podcast I was doing last season. We'll be doing that on Mondays and Fridays, about a 20 to 30 minute show going in depth on the world of Major League Baseball. You know, with the format there, we'll have some series picks. I'll give you some things of that sort. Look ahead, preview some of the games, give you some situational spots to look at, pitchers, teams set for regression, things of that sort. So it'll be on Mondays and Fridays going forward. Although it will not be on this Monday, July 4th. It's a holiday, obviously, so plenty of things going on. We'll see if I do put something out, maybe Sunday night, some kind of thing like that. We'll have to see how things play out. But then coming up Wednesday and Thursday, we'll have our regular Bang the Book Radio hour-long live broadcasts. That's how things are going to be for the month of July, except for the All-Star break. We'll have live Wednesday, Thursday shows with Wes Reynolds on Wednesdays, Jordan Biaki on Thursdays, and hopefully if schedules work out, you'll be able to get Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com on either Wednesday or Thursday on weeks with UFC events. We'll be chatting with Aaron Saunders of NowBangTheBook.com. If you missed that big announcement earlier in the week, Aaron Saunders going to be writing for us. He's going to be looking at team season win total over and under for one team in every conference. So he'll have an over pick, an under pick, for all 10 conferences that I'll be rolling out throughout the summer at bangthebook.com. And he wants to come on the show and talk a little bit about the process, go in depth on some of those conferences. So we'll have some of those segments coming throughout the summer months here. And then of course, as I mentioned on Wednesday or yesterday's show, actually, Wes Reynolds also going to be joining our lineup of writers at bangthebook.com. So we're very excited about that. But again, these show changes start next week. You won't hear anything, at least tentatively, you won't hear anything on Monday, nothing on Tuesday, and then Wednesday and Thursday we'll have our regular one-hour live show. So you'll still be getting 4 days a week of content, again, aside from the All-Star break. But, you know, we'll still be bringing you the stuff that you've come to expect from BangTheBook.com. We'll still have all of our great content over at the website at BangTheBook.com. So definitely make sure that you're taking advantage of that. As far as today's show goes, I'm going to have some blurbs here on the Major League Baseball card for Friday night. And then I've got a long segment that I recorded last night with Kyle Kensing of CFBHuddle.com. It should be a lot of fun for you. We talked about college football week one lines for the Pac-12 teams. And then we went totally off the rails with a politics discussion, including a very interesting question of whether or not Dwayne The Rock Johnson would ever have a shot at winning the presidency. And we talked about that a little bit. And I know it was something that Kyle really enjoyed and something that I enjoyed as well. So, you know, that'll be how we'll wrap up the show here on Bang the Book Radio with a little bit of a lighthearted, you know, conclusion to this week heading into a holiday weekend. And of course, I hope everybody out there has a happy and safe July 4th weekend here. But as far as the Major League Baseball side of things goes for tonight, you know, I talked up looking for this spot here to fade the Cleveland Indians against the Toronto Blue Jays. And we're seeing money come in on Toronto here this morning. This number opened around minus 120. Now this number sitting some books at minus 130. The Chris books, DSI, and Pinnacle both going up to that 130 plateau. This makes a lot of sense. You know, I talked about the situational spot for the Indians. I thought they were okay last night, and of course they were, and Carlos Carrasco was filthy in that game. If Carlos Carrasco is back, this Indians rotation is, I mean, it's stacked already, but I mean, the stuff that he had last night, his changeup, you know, I watch every Indians game, whether I'm there or whether I'm watching on TV. His changeup last night was one of the best pitches I've seen an Indian starter throw in a long, long time. I mean, it was just, it had so much bite down there, dropping out of the zone at 91. You can't hit pitch. That's exactly what it was for Carrasco last night. But today, You know, this is the eighth game of a 10-game road trip for them. And they're playing free and easy. They're not playing like a team that's bothered by the streak. You know, I mean, they've won some close games. They've gutted out a couple of them. They had a couple close games in Atlanta. Of course, last night's game kind of hung in the balance there a little bit, particularly with Brian Shaw's appearance in the eighth. But this is not a team playing with the pressure of a winning streak. But eighth game of a 10-game road trip, this is the third different city. You know, they got in very early Thursday morning flying up from Atlanta. This is a bad spot for the Indians. Unfortunately for me, the oddsmakers priced me out. You know, Josh Tomlin is a guy that the oddsmakers aren't too high on, but, you know, I mean, Tomlin's been really good this season. Actually been one of the most profitable pitchers to back, and yeah, he gives up some home runs, but he doesn't walk guys. So they're, you know, largely solo home runs or maybe two-run shots. It's the three-run shots in the Grand Slams that really put you behind the eight ball. You know, if you're down by two, a bloop and a blast can get you back in the game. If you're down by three or four, you got to string some innings together, that type of thing. So that's one thing that Josh Tomlin really excels at, and I don't think the odds makers accurately appreciate that. You know, I mean, Tomlin, in this Indians winning streak, they've been an underdog twice. Tomlin was the underdog in Detroit against Justin Verlander, and then that was a game that they wound up winning. But as far as this one today, unfortunately for me, the odds makers priced me out of the Blue Jays. However, I think tomorrow, whether the Indians win or lose today, I think tomorrow is an outstanding day to go against the Indians. You've got them with the opportunity to go out tonight, enjoy that Toronto nightlife, live up the spoils of this winning streak. Trevor Bauer goes up against Marco Estrada. Bauer has been really, really good of late. Chris Giménez has done a fantastic job navigating him through starts. I'm not necessarily worried too much about Bauer. Estrada, you know, a guy due for some regression, at least, you know, from in a historical sense, his BABIP is the lowest we've ever seen. And I've talked about his ability to carry a low BABIP because of the location that he's able to, you know, to have with his fastball and with his changeup. But for Estrada here, you know, I think this is a spot where he could take advantage of an Indians team that may come to the park, maybe a little bit hungover. And also, you know, again, ninth game of a 10-game road trip. So I think Saturday is a brilliant opportunity to go against the Indians. We'll see if things play out that way, especially if they lose tonight. You know, if you remember, one of my best NHL plays of the season was when the Blackhawks had that big winning streak, and then they wound up losing to Calgary, and it was like a 4-0 loss, something like that. It was the game immediately following the end of their winning streak, and I'm sure listeners out there remember that one, the ones that have been with us, you know, since back when the middle of the hockey regular season was going on. But you kind of get this letdown factor, you know, after a winning streak. You're playing so well. Everything's going in your favor. You lose a game, and the balloon kind of pops a little bit. So if the Indians lose this day game today, I think it's a phenomenal spot to go against them tomorrow. I think it's a good spot regardless. But if they lose, you know, then I think it's a really, really good spot to go against them. So have to see where that number opens with Bauer and Estrada. I think Estrada's probably a small favorite in that one. But you'll have to see how that game plays out. Another game that's really on my radar here today, the Cubs and the Mets. Jason Hamill going up against Jacob DeGrom. And I really, really love the Mets in this spot tonight. I've had a hard time backing the Mets this season. I mean, they're like the Indians in the sense of their starting pitching. But their offense just hasn't really been trustworthy to me. They've been laying some bigger numbers than usual. But tonight, love them here. This game, a little bit less than a money line pick 'em. You've got the Mets about a -110 favorite, but Jason Hamill, 2.58 ERA, 3.89 FIP, 4.36 xFIP, 2.46 BABIP against, 83.3% strand rate. All of these things point to signs of regression for Jason Hamill. Now, you generally don't see a guy's BABIP improve when he starts inducing more ground balls because, as I've talked about before here on the show, more ground balls go for hits than fly balls. So generally speaking, you'll see, you know, these fly ball pitchers with lower BABIPs because A, you know, fly balls, guys have time to run under them, and B, they give up home runs and home runs don't count towards BABIP. With guys that are inducing more ground balls, you know, balls just find holes. Stuff's not hit at fielders. You know, maybe a fielder gets a bad first step, all these types of things. You generally tend to see higher BABIPs from ground ball guys. This year, Jason Hamill's ground ball rate has jumped up a few percentage points. And you know, when you get something like that, you generally expect the BABIP to regress a little bit. Last year, a 38.3% ground ball rate and a 288 BABIP. This year, 44.2% ground ball rate, a .246 BABIP. That's 54 points below his career average. And his ground ball rate's gone up 6% this year. I don't see Jason Hamill as sustainable, and I really like what Jacob deGrom has been doing here lately. Since May 27th, and that's kind of an arbitrary start date, but deGrom's posted a .225 ERA with a .254 FIP, .265 xFIP, 47 strikeouts and 8 walks in 40 innings. You got to keep in mind here with Jacob deGrom, his wife was pregnant and was due in the month of April, and they had some serious complications with the pregnancy. From what I gather from the media reports, things were kind of touch and go a little bit there for a while. You know, maybe the baby wasn't going to make it through. It's really hard to pitch through that type of thing. You know, a lot of times we don't know what's going on with these baseball players. Some of them could be going through a divorce. You know, pregnancies are always, I mean, it's a major, major life change. Both, you know, the anxiety of it, you know, you lose sleep, it changes your circadian rhythm around. These are things that a lot of times we don't think about with individual players. And with DeGrom, his was so highly publicized that, you know, he was out there having to go out, answer all these questions to the media, you know, try to be there for his wife, try to be there for his newborn son. It's difficult. But now that the kid seems to be healthy, you know, we haven't heard anything else about it. DeGrom has gone back to being the elite level starting pitcher that he is. I think this number is way too short tonight. I think there's too much respect for the Cubs, too much respect for Hamill. Really like the New York Mets here in this game tonight. I want to touch on Baltimore and Seattle because I think by the time you listen to this show, we're going to see a pretty big line move here in this game. And in fact, it's already starting with Kevin Gausman up against Wade LeBlanc. LeBlanc and the Mariners opened about a minus 120 favorite here in this one. We've already seen this flip to Baltimore being favored at some shops, and I completely agree with that stance. Kevin Gausman is a guy, he's very interesting, and this is something you want to pay attention to here, reverse platoon splits. Sometimes they're not always sustainable, but for Gausman this year, he's held lefties to a .226 average with a .264 on base and a .341 slugging. Righties are batting .283 with a .340 on base and a .500 slugging. 10 of the 12 home runs he's given up have come from right-handed sticks. Now we go and look at the Mariners against righties on the year. They have a .333 WOBA with a .111 weighted runs created plus. But a big reason for this here is because their left-handed hitters do so much damage, and it's really surprising, you know, to see a guy with such obvious reverse platoon splits like Gausman. And he's taking on a team where the lefties do a lot of the damage. I mean, the left-handed hitters against right-handed pitching for the Mariners have posted a .115 weighted runs created plus on the season. That's really, really good. It's up there in the top 10 in that metric. So you kind of neutralize those guys a little bit with the arsenal that Gausman has, and it gives them some value. And Wade LeBlanc, I mean, this is a guy that was AAA fodder a couple weeks ago, a fringe 4A player throughout his career. He's favored over Baltimore, who leads the American League East. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. Baltimore's going to close a favorite here. We'll see if they win or not, but definitely some line value in the Orioles here for tonight's game. I want to touch on a couple of other games here quickly. Texas and Minnesota. You've got Martin Perez, a minus 120 favorite for the Rangers against the Minnesota Twins. Martin Perez is one of those guys in that Rangers rotation that I'm looking for serious regression from. If you missed yesterday's show, I talked extensively about the Texas Rangers, about their base runs record, about their Pythagorean win-loss record, also about their third-order wins winning percentage, or their third-order winning percentage. And you know, none of it adds up. None of it adds up for this team to be as good as they are. And it's because of guys like Martin Perez that they've been able to overachieve the metrics so much. Perez is 7-4 on the year with a .344 ERA. Really good. 74 FIP, a .492 xFIP. You know, he's got one of the lowest strikeout percentages in Major League Baseball. Terrible walk rate for a guy that doesn't miss bats. His strikeout percentage minus walk percentage, K minus BB percentage, 1.5%. That is embarrassingly bad. .273 BABIP against, 78.6% strand rate as a pitch-to-contact ground ball artist. This is a guy that's due for a significant amount of regression. He's got a .532 Sierra on the season, 32.8% hard contact rate, doesn't induce any pop-ups whatsoever this year. This is a guy that regression should hit in a pretty big way. Now, does it happen tonight? I don't know. I don't know if Minnesota is the team to deal that blow. The Twins, 23rd in the league in WOBA against lefties. But they do have a decent slugging percentage against lefties. So maybe they can come through, do something a little bit surprising here. But that's why we see the money coming in on Minnesota at some shops. Number open minus 125. It's down to minus 115 at some places. But again, I'm looking for regression from Texas. I could go bankrupt doing it, and I know that my buddy MLB Dream Picks has had a very hard time losing quite a bit of money going against Texas this season. But Martin Perez, if you're going to do it, he's the guy that you probably want to do it against. I think that Minnesota definitely has some value here tonight, even as this number continues to go down. Another game I want to look at, the Yankees and the Padres. Yankees open about a minus 110, minus 120 favorite in this one here tonight. They take on a Padres lineup that is 30th in WOBA against right-handed pitching. And Nate Eovaldi is a guy that, I thought that maybe he had turned the corner. This is a guy with a really, really spectacular arsenal in terms of a fastball with premium velocity, a decent splitter, a slider that's got some movement to it. And yet, for whatever reason, things just haven't come together for Nate Eovaldi in his career. And you look at how things have gone for him over his last five starts. He's given up at least four runs in all of them. He's given up 25 runs in his last five starts. And that's really killed all of his numbers. 5.19 ERA, 4.87 FIP, 3.86 xFIP. In those last five starts, the biggest problem for him has been the long ball. He's given up 10 home runs in his last five starts, four of them in his last start against the Minnesota Twins. Now, this is a type of situation, sort of like the James Shields situation that we had earlier this week, where you can buy a pitcher at his low point. And this line was bad when it came out. At minus 130, some of the value is gone. Of course, the Yankees losing a hitter by going to a National League. But Colin Ray is a below-average starter. And the Yankees, it's not a great spot because they played at home. They played a getaway day game against Texas on Thursday. It's not ideal. That first road game, can be kind of tricky. But I think this is a bounce-back spot for Eovaldi. So I do think that there's still a little bit of value on the Yankees as this number continues to climb, the value running away pretty quickly there. But if you want to take some late-night action, I think that this is probably the game that you want to focus on. That Baltimore-Seattle game, Baltimore is going to close a favorite in that one. So if you can catch them at any kind of underdog price, you'll get some closing line value on that number. So just some thoughts on a couple of the late games. Give you some good thoughts here on the early slate, also the afternoon slate. Today's show going to run a little bit long. I didn't realize I had talked to Kyle Kensing for so long last night because we were having such a blast doing that segment. But here is that segment with Kyle Kensing of CFBHuddle.com, looking at week one college football lines, some perception of some of those teams, and then also politics discussion and some thoughts on The Rock as the possible president of the United States of America one day. All right, I'm joined now by Kyle Kensing of CFBHuddle.com. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
It's going all right. Summer's going by quickly, as I mentioned to you off the air, but how about you? How are you doing?
Doing very well. No complaints from me. I know you said, 2 weeks until Pac-12 media days, so things really are starting to happen quickly here.
Exactly. I sort of feel like media days is the point in the summer when things start to really roll downhill fast. The SEC is the same week as Pac-12 this year, which is the first time that's ever happened. So it's kind of just a downhill race from that point. It'll be Labor Day weekend before we know it.
I know we talked a couple of weeks ago. We gave some general thoughts on the Pac-12 season win totals, some of the schedule analysis type of stuff. In your preseason preparations over there at CFBHuddle.com or in anything else that you've written for Athlon or for Today's You, any of your opinions change on the Pac-12 since we last spoke?
Not so much. I still really feel the way that I did a few weeks ago looking at it, that I feel like the conference is wide open. I don't think that there's a legitimate playoff contender anywhere to be found in this field. The season altogether kind of reminds me a little bit of 2009, who I was talking with a friend about that season just today, as a matter of fact, and how that year there was about four or five teams that could legitimately win the conference. Now, I think the difference this time around is the league is collectively much better. I just don't see a real playoff contender, but I could see any one of legitimately four teams in the South winning it, and in the North, I feel like any one of four could win it as well. So you're talking about eight teams that I feel like could realistically get to the conference title game.
Well, we were kind of talking about that a little bit. Is it the Pac-12 once again is setting up to be one of those conferences where everybody kind of beats everybody, and when you get a situation like that, you know, then it's very difficult to have your team represent, you know, the conference in the college football playoff, just because, you know, a 10-2 or a 9-3 type of team may end up being the Pac-12 champion after that conference tournament or conference title game, and you know, then you, I mean, you're on the outside looking in at the playoff at that point.
Exactly. And I look at some of the Stanford teams like 2013 and this past year, both of those teams I felt like could legitimately have won the national championship. You know, they had some bad breaks go against them each of those seasons. In particular, last year with Stanford, you know, that Northwestern game in week one, that's a tough draw. And then with the Oregon game, they fumbled quarterback center exchanges twice in the red zone. But that's a team that, you know, if you score a touchdown there in, against Oregon in the red zone, I feel like they could have beaten Alabama or they could have beaten Clemson if they had gotten to that point. But I don't see anybody being that strong this year.
Well, we're going to start here and take a little bit of a look at the week one lines because we've got all the preseason magazines out now. Of course, I picked my copy of Phil Steele's magazine to help me out with, you know, looking at last year's production, past production, all the transfers, catching up on all that stuff because – really, when you're handicapping college football, that's three-fourths of the bet at this point is realizing who's still there, who's come in, where all the coaches have gone, all those types of things. And we'll start with the game in Sydney on August 26th between Cal and Hawaii. Cal, right now at the Chris Books, DSI, and Bookmaker, laying north of three touchdowns here, 21.5. Is it going to be Davis Webb, the Texas Tech transfer, under center for the Golden Bears, or will Sonny Dykes go in a different direction?
I think Davis Webb is pretty certain to be the starting quarterback, given the options that he had in his free agency, let's call it, you know, including Colorado, where, you know, there's no guarantee that Seth Olufau is going to be available by week one. I think the fact that Webb was shopping around so much, you're not going to come in without some sort of, I don't want to say guarantee, but relative assurance that you're going to be the starting quarterback. It'll be a really smooth transition for him to run that offense. You know, there's a lot of similarities between Tech and Cal in terms of what they do schematically. I do think he's going to be the guy to take over. I think, you know, you're going to replace Jared Goff, a three-year starter. Davis Webb's a good guy to go with, in part because he's more mobile than Goff. You know, he certainly doesn't have the same kind of field vision, you know, that make Goff so coveted by the NFL. But I think that mobility adds kind of a nice dynamic, especially with Cal replacing top six pass catchers from a season ago.
Well, that's a really interesting thing to bring up here because, you know, Hawaii is a good way to ease into the season. And for Cal, it's going to be a little bit of a unique situation. Of course, you know, it's not like you play in Australia all the time. So both of these teams dealing with some distractions here going into this opening game. But Cal, as you mentioned, you know, new offensive personnel across the map, except for Kalfani Muhammad, who's back as the running back. Do you feel like that's something that, you know, could allow Hawaii to maybe hang around a little bit here?
You know, I think it's certainly possible. You know, Hawaii's going through some changes of its own, you know, with Matthew Rolovich coming in as the new head coach after the Norm Chow experiment didn't quite work out. But, you know, for them, that Australia trip is shorter than it is for Cal. You don't have the same advantage that you get playing there in Honolulu, which tripped up Colorado in week one last season. But still, you know, a shorter flight for them. They'll be going through some changes of their own, so I don't know that it's necessarily going to be a huge advantage for Hawaii. But there in week one, there is a bit of a feeling out process. I think it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, how Cal does make some of those changes because, you know, on top of losing so much in terms of personnel, they also have a new offensive coordinator with Tony Franklin having left in the offseason.
Yeah, and that's always an interesting thing to look at as well. You know, we do have a lot of coaching changes. Jake Spavital from Texas A&M, the new offensive coordinator, and of course, you know, we know what A&M has done offensively over the last few years, so it's not like that's a bad hire by any means. But again, some scheme changes in there and that type of thing. This isn't necessarily Pac-12 related, but Hawaii plays this game in Australia to start the year. Then they go all the way to Ann Arbor to get crushed by Michigan as a 42-point dog. And then they come back to the island to host UT Martin. So I understand that Hawaii has to do this for financial reasons, but that is incredibly brutal.
Yeah, Hawaii, that's such an interesting dynamic to me with them. I sort of feel like they would be the perfect school to go independent because of the travel demands on them. I feel like they can start the season in September when the weather's really nice and teams are looking for non-conference games. You know, you can get a big-name Power 5 program to come out to the island. You know, their fans want to travel and everything. And, you know, like Colorado lost there last year. But a lot of times teams like Wisconsin will go out there and play, and they'll win, you know. So it's a bye game, but it's also a little bit of a sort of early season bowl almost to a certain extent. I feel like if Hawaii was able to get a schedule where they play three home games to start the year in September, and then they go on the road kind of as a traveling road show in October and the early part of November, finish out the season at Thanksgiving time when it's the holidays and people are traveling again at home, that would be the ideal situation for them. I don't necessarily know that that would work. You know, they would have to be playing games on internet pay-per-view or something like that. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think that this schedule for them right now is ideal.
No, and last year they played 13 straight weeks without a bye week from what I remember. So, you know, obviously that was something that didn't work out for them at all with all the travel that they have, even to these Mountain West Conference opponents. I mean, yeah, they're used to the trips, but still, I mean, that's a long way to go each and every week. So definitely feel bad for the Rainbow Warriors, that's for sure. A team that we may end up feeling bad for again this season is the Oregon State Beavers. They're a 10-point dog. They take on Minnesota here in week one on Thursday night, one of a handful of Thursday night games featuring some power conference teams. But Oregon State here, you know, an interesting dynamic with Daryl Gerritsen now at quarterback, second year for Gary Anderson. Do you feel like this Oregon State team can, you know, toughen up and stiffen up a little bit more this year and be a little bit more competitive?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I feel like they'll be a little bit better defensively. On offense, I'm really intrigued to see what they do because Gary Anderson is running much different concepts than Mike Riley. Interestingly enough with Daryl Gerritsen is that's a guy that Gary Anderson actually recruited at Utah State. He didn't get to coach because he had taken the Wisconsin job shortly thereafter. But with Matt Wells, you know, Matt Wells was a guy that had, you know, a connection to Gary Anderson there. So for Daryl Gerritsen, I think this is kind of a neat situation where he gets to play for the coach that originally recruited him. It's going to be exciting to see how that works. Now, I thought Seth Collins was a star in the making, so the fact that that didn't quite work out where he's now a wide receiver, I'll be interested to see if they're able to use him in some kind of unique ways, you know, some trick plays where he's able to throw the ball. Because he's a good runner, too, on top of having played quarterback last season for them. But, you know, real growing pains. I think they'll continue to have some growing pains. They might not get blown out quite as badly as they did much of last season, but I think they're going to have a real hard time improving on that 2-10 mark, you know. And opening with Minnesota, a team that, you know, plays a really kind of physical style of ball, I don't see them being that competitive in this game. I think Minnesota will be able to kind of dictate the pace of that one.
I do kind of wonder, I mean, Gary Anderson, probably familiar with some of these Minnesota kids, probably tried to recruit them in his days at Wisconsin, of course, familiar with Big Ten style football. So maybe that's something that could help the Beavers a little bit in this spot. And Minnesota is an interesting team because they're kind of one of those middle of the road Big Ten teams, but without the Jerry Kill factor, and Jerry Kill, you know, a very, very good head coach, a solid recruiter. It's really unfortunate that his health issues prevent him from being on the sideline. But with Minnesota last year under Tracy Clays, they didn't seem like the same team. I don't know if maybe it was just a regression thing off of what happened, you know, with the back-to-back 8 and 5 years, but I don't know. I think it's a good litmus test for Oregon State right away. And maybe we find out, you know, that we could have been a little bit low on this team, or we find out that, you know, they are who we thought they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that with Jerry Kill because he, to me, is one of the most underrated coaches in college football. And I think that now that he was forced into premature retirement, we might get a sense of just how underrated he was. I think Minnesota really overachieved quite a bit under him, especially that 2014 team, you know, that finished the season ranked in the top 25. They really played above their talent level. And that's a difficult thing for any coach to do, especially at a Power 5 conference.
Well, look at a very, very quality game here on Friday night. Maybe the best game on Friday night, depending on how Toledo and Arkansas State lives up to its billing. But Colorado State, you know, this one, of course, at, you know, what essentially amounts to a neutral site, but not really. You know, they're in Denver. We'll have to see which team is more well represented. But Colorado's a team that we discussed on our previous segment, and they're a team that, you know, you like Mike McIntyre's squad a little bit here this year.
I do, yeah. I think Colorado this season, I do think they're going to get to a bowl game. I do think they're going to finish above 500. You know, looking at some of the games they have in Pac-12 play, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, I think they're going to knock somebody out of that Pac-12 South race with a win at home. Now, for my prediction to come true on them making a bowl game, I think it's imperative that they play well in non-conference, and that kind of starts with Colorado State. You know, Colorado State's a good program, and it's a rivalry matchup. You still can't afford to lose to a Mountain West team if you're trying to break through to that that bowl game level. So I think this one's going to set a really important tone. And going back earlier, I mentioned Sefo Lufau. His health and his availability for this game, I think, is going to play a huge factor in how Colorado shapes up, because with him in the lineup, they're able to throw the ball really well. He's got a great arm, and it'll be his fourth year as a starting quarterback. But that kind of a lot hinges on that to me. You know, it's I think these are going to be two pretty evenly matched teams. I think CSU is probably the second best team in that Mountain Division in the Mountain West this year. You know, I think Mike Bobo is a good coach. I was kind of coming into his own a little bit last year. You saw Colorado State take a big leap in Jim McElwain's second season. I kind of see the same thing for them, you know, in Bobo's second year. So this is really I agree with you. I think this might be one of the best games of that opening weekend. I should say low key. That Saturday's loaded, but in terms of the weekday games, I think this might be one of the better ones.
Colorado, a 9-point favorite here in this one. You know, it's definitely the kind of game that both teams really put a lot of emphasis on, and I kind of like the idea of playing this rivalry game right away at the beginning of the schedule, because it forces both of these teams to be ready at the start, and maybe that's something that could benefit Colorado here a little bit, whereas, you know, some of these other teams play FCS schools that are local, or, you know, maybe play some other sort of cupcake type of opponent. So maybe that's something that can benefit Colorado moving forward. And again, with Colorado State, second year of Mike Bobo, you know, that's really the big thing to me is, you know, in year one, I want to see teams progressively get better throughout the season as they get coached up a little bit more. But there in year two is where you'd like to see some strides. And for Colorado State, you know, coming off of that 7-6 season, you know, I don't know. I don't know if maybe that does feel like it's kind of their ceiling. And you know, the Mountain West has gotten a little bit more balanced in terms of, you know, overall talent level and record over the last couple of years.
Yeah, you know, and with Colorado State, they're an interesting story because in the latter days of the original, well, I don't want to say original because, you know, Arizona and Arizona State were gone, but the classic WAC conference, there were a lot of teams that would finish in the top 25. You know, there was one season where I think the WAC had four top 25 teams. You know, Air Force was awesome there under Fisher DeBerry. Utah, BYU was fantastic at that time. But Colorado State under Sonny Lubick in the mid-90s to about the early 2000s was a perennial top 25 program. And I thought that Jim McElwain had done a nice job of kind of getting them close to that level again in 2014. You know, I think Colorado State, in terms of the Mountain West teams, has the potential to be one of the best perennially. And I think that Bobo has that same kind of ability as McElwain to get them to that level. You know, he's got the SEC credentials, and he's got a style of play that's conducive to guys who want to try to get to the NFL. So that's a good recruiting tool for them. And they're building a new stadium. I think that new stadium is going to be a real boon for Colorado State going forward, you know, to the point where it might even attract some interest from the Big 12. I know that's been kicked around a little bit in the offseason.
Well, Stanford and Kansas State, another intriguing Friday night game, not necessarily because of the result, because Stanford's a 16-point favorite, so obviously they're supposed to take care of business here in this one. But, you know, obviously we know Bill Snyder's track record, and this is a guy that, you know, when they're not supposed to win, they either play really well or win the game outright. In terms of season openers for Kansas State over the last 5 years, Eastern Kentucky, Missouri State, North Dakota State, Stephen F. Austin, South Dakota. So you're asking a team that generally relies pretty heavily on JUCO transfers to be ready right away. Now, Stanford, you know, Kevin Hogan out of the picture. We'll see if Keller Christ is the guy. But I think this is an important game for both teams to get off on the right foot, for Kansas State to show up and play well, and for Stanford to take care of business when they're supposed to.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting about Kansas State's non-conference openers in the past, because I was actually thinking about that. When was the last time that KSU played a real marquee week one game? And I couldn't think of a time. You know, I always kind of picture them opening slow. And then sometime around mid-September, they would play somebody. Like last year, it was Auburn. You know, and when they would get those games in Manhattan, Colin last season comparing it to the Children of the Corn, you know, where it was this team that you don't think would necessarily be very formidable. You go into their territory there in the cornfields, and they kind of beat up on you a little bit. I think having to actually go to the farm doesn't suit them particularly well. And I don't think that they have the athleticism to match up with Stanford, which is weird to say. You know, you don't think of a Stanford team as being athletic. You think of them as playing that physical smash-mouth style. But, you know, with Christian McCaffrey, they really flipped the script last season. You know, and Keller Crist was a high four-star recruit, you know, really kind of bided his time and learned the system. So I think he'll be able to step in with no problem in that quarterback role.
Kansas State hosted UCLA in the season opener in 2010. So that's their, you know, last big marquee opponent. But again, you know, not out on the road. So this is definitely a different dynamic for them. Kansas State, and looking at their advanced schedule here for the non-conference, they get Stanford at home in 2021 to fulfill this home-and-home series, Arizona in 2024 and 2025, Washington State in 26 and 29, Colorado in 27 and 28. So Kansas State definitely adding some Pac-12 flavor to their future schedules. But, you know, by that time, Bill Snyder will be long gone, hopefully just in a coaching sense, you know, but we'll see what the future holds for him. But, I mean, that guy is – he's phenomenal. And, you know, I have to think that – there's probably going to be some money coming in on Kansas State for that opener, even though it is a tough draw just because of that Bill Snyder factor.
Yeah, I think the Bill Snyder factor definitely would have to play into it a little bit. Plus the fact that Stanford last year, you got to remember, you know, against Northwestern, I don't know what the line was for that game last year, but who could have thought that they would go in and score only 6 points in that season opener? You know, it's a little bit different going on the road, especially when you're going, you know, a pretty decent distance from the Bay Area to Chicago versus playing at home. Nevertheless, that game last season is a bit of a reminder that week one isn't necessarily the same team that you're going to see in November. And to that end, you know, Stanford could be working out some kinks still at that point.
That was Stanford minus 10.5 there in that game at Northwestern. So, you know, that one, obviously that game didn't work out for them at all whatsoever. This is a fascinating one to me on Saturday afternoon between Rutgers and Washington. Now, Washington, this is really unfortunate from a handicapping standpoint, because you and I talked about Washington at the tail end of this past college football season, saying that, you know, this is a legitimate team. It started a freshman quarterback, that this is a team that has a chance to win the Pac-12 North. Unfortunately, everybody has piled on that Washington train. It's one of the few week one numbers that has moved quite a bit. It's actually 21.5 to 24. Now, again, no key numbers in there from a handicapping standpoint, but people are taking notice of Washington, and their stock is extremely high right now. And that's cause for concern in the handicapping community, because when everybody's on a team, you kind of tend to start finding ways to try and talk yourself out of them.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, as you're well aware, because I was talking them up last November, I have been on the Washington bandwagon for some time, and it really makes me nervous to see so many people piling on at this point. It reminds me a little bit of, this is going back a few years, but in 99, Arizona was coming off a fantastic season, actually probably the best season in program history. They went 12-1 in 98. They beat Nebraska in the Holiday Bowl, back when the Holiday Bowl was probably one of the five or six best in the country. And they're returning not everybody, but most everybody. And I think they were number three to open 99. Everybody was riding with them big time. They go into Penn State week one with LeVar Arrington and Courtney Brown and get annihilated. And that game set the program back an entire decade. Now, Washington doesn't play a Penn State in the non-conference, but I still think when you're getting hyped up so much, well, where you can get that week one letdown, you know, Rutgers is a really veteran team. I want to say that they're returning 18 total starters. I believe they're the most veteran team in the Big Ten this season. And, you know, and they have to go across the country, and they have a new head coach. But nevertheless, I mean, that's kind of prime opportunity to plant your flag if you're a team that's kind of on the come up, you know, with a first-year guy. So that game does make me nervous. I think Washington wins it because I am still high on them. But boy, I'm starting to get cold feet with the Huskies a little bit.
Well, we'll have to see what happens here with Rutgers, because Chris Ash, I think, is a guy that can build this program in short order. I mean, you know, New Jersey's not a recruiting hotbed like a California or a Florida or a Texas or, you know, Ohio or anything like that. But there's still a lot of kids that can really ball out in that area. And
it's
on, you know, Rutgers,
lot, yeah.
Well, another thing about Rutgers is, you know, there's such a bad taste in everybody's mouth with everything that's gone on within the athletic department. So it's a tough sell for Chris Ash right now. But if he's able to build this program into something respectable, we know that the basketball team had all sorts of issues in Big Ten play. So it's probably going to have to come from the football side. But, you know, again, I mean, this is a team that you're going to have a lot of players on this team that were overlooked. Players are going to have a chip on their shoulders. And for Chris Ash's sake, that's what you want. You want motivated players. And as you mentioned, a lot of returning starters, 9 on the offensive side of the ball. And look, their offense, I mean, it wasn't terrible last year. They scored 27 points per game. It was the defense that was bad. Ash, a defensive-minded guy. If this number continues to go up, and I think that there's a decent chance that it will, because, you know, no one wants to bet Rutgers, there could be some value on the Scarlet Knights here in week 1 for sure.
Yeah, and you know, and I like what you mentioned about New Jersey and the recruiting there, because that is growing into a little bit more of a battleground state. There's a reason that Jim Harbaugh planted a satellite camp flag out. It's really growing quite a bit. And going back a few years to when Al Golden was at Temple, I had done a big story on Temple's kind of resurgence under him. And he sent me a postcard after I wrote the story. And on the postcard, there was a little tagline on it that said, winning with homegrown talent. There is a lot of talent there in that New Jersey, Philadelphia area. And if you can kind of start to get people locally to buy in, I think you can build a pretty nice program there at Rutgers.
Well, another fascinating week 1 game. And this one, I don't know if it's going to get the respect that it deserves, but it certainly should, between UCLA and Texas A&M. Texas A&M, a 2-point favorite right now for this game. A very tumultuous offseason for Texas A&M. They had a lot of guys leave the program, particularly at the quarterback position. They do wind up getting Trevor Knight in there, which, you know, obviously is, at this point, I mean, almost a godsend given the exodus of talent from that program.
Yeah.
But, you know, UCLA here, I mean, this is a UCLA team with Josh Rosen. They're expected to be one of the best teams in the Pac-12. Going out on the road, a short chalk to College Station, which is one of the biggest stadiums in the country. Huge home field advantage for A&M. This line would suggest that UCLA is favored over A&M on a neutral. Is that a stance that you agree with?
Yeah, you know, I think on a neutral, I would agree with that. In part because part of Texas A&M's strength is based on that passing attack. And the other thing to keep in mind with this game is Texas A&M's new offensive coordinator, replacing Jake Spavital, you mentioned previously, who's now at Cal, Noel Mazzoni, spent the last 4 years at UCLA. So this is a defense that's very familiar with what Texas A&M is going to run conceptually. Not only that, I would say UCLA probably has the best secondary in the Pac-12, maybe in all of college football. So that kind of neutralizes one of A&M's real primary weapons, I feel like. But the fact that it is an SEC country, that's a real position. I think a little bit of Arizona State going to play in A&M last year in Houston, which for all intents and purposes was a road game. I think that losing that game in the fashion that they did, you know, having to go and prove themselves there in the heart of SEC country, really kind of set ASU back for the entire season. I do worry about that for UCLA. I think that this can be the kind of loss that's debilitating for a full season for a team. But on a neutral field, I like UCLA in that matchup, and I do think that they're going to have a little bit of an edge knowing what A&M's going to rely on conceptually.
One of the things about UCLA that kind of stood out to me last year, and you know, maybe it's a trend that we'll end up seeing this year, but they've struggled a little bit with physical teams. And fortunately for them, Texas A&M, you know, very, very much a skill-based offense, a big play type of defense with a lot of athleticism. They're not going to come and hit you all that hard. So from that standpoint, maybe it is a little bit of a favorable matchup for UCLA, at least as favorable as you can get. But again, as you talk about going down to SEC country, you know, you got to be ready to go right from the jump. And that's not an easy thing to do for UCLA. I mean, again, a team that has opened with the likes of, you know, Rice, Nevada, Virginia in back-to-back seasons. So major step up in class here for them. And whereas Texas A&M, you know, they played South Carolina in the opener a couple of years ago, Arizona State, as you mentioned, They played Florida back in 2012. So, you know, kind of two different types of preparations here over the last few years. Now both of these teams have to try and get themselves on the same level.
Yeah, and with UCLA, what's going to be interesting to see is their offensive line last season made a lot of strides. They've been one of the worst at giving up sacks in the entire country for a few years when Brett Hundley was the quarterback. But last year with Rosen and trying to work more kind of pro style, slightly, ever so slightly, they gave up way less sacks. You know, with Myles Garrett, who's probably the best pass rusher in the country, they're going to have to continue that, but they're going to now a pretty exclusively pro-style offense. And I really like Connor McDermott at left tackle. I think he's going to be a guy who, over the course of the season, is going to start getting some first-round draft buzz. And this is going to be a chance for him to prove himself. So I think UCLA, it's really a huge measuring stick game for them.
Speaking of measuring stick games, Oregon plays UC Davis. No, I'm kidding. Oregon's going to crush UC Davis. Actually, arguably the biggest game of the night, at least the two biggest college football brands in action against each other, USC, Alabama at Jerry World, AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas. So a very, very neutral site game here, and both of these fan bases should travel fairly well to this one. You know, obviously for Alabama, so much to replace, but they do that year after year, and they generally don't have a problem with it. As far as USC goes, you're replacing a guy in Cody Kessler who – maybe he didn't live up to the expectations completely, but one of the last things you want playing Alabama is having to go with an inexperienced quarterback under center.
Yeah, boy, that's a real tough proposition. I've seen Max Brown up close and personal in practices for the last few years. I think he's supremely talented, and I think he's a very smart kid. And I think he's going to have a good year if he ends up being the starter. You know, it's still open between him and Sam Darnold. But Sam Darnold's another smart player, really athletic, brings some mobility. But you never want to open your career against Alabama. And I just – this is the classic bad matchup game, I feel like. I have a real difficult time envisioning a scenario in which USC is competitive in this game. You know, I could be wrong. He's got some great linebackers who I think might be able to put some pressure on whoever the quarterback for Alabama ends up being, which last season, you know, Wisconsin was able to hang with Alabama through the first half of that matchup, you know, with Cooper Bateman was, I believe, the week one starter. You know, Wisconsin put a lot of pressure on him. So I expect something similar in terms of USC's defensive approach. But offensively, they're going to have a tough time putting up points in that game.
Alabama, 10-point favorite in this one, again, at a neutral site. So you know, that gives you some kind of idea on what the odds makers are looking at from a power rating standpoint right now. Alabama probably up there in the 95, 96 type of range. So USC, as of now, you know, sort of in that probably 86 to 87 range. I don't think it's a full 10, but probably the fact that Alabama, you know, I mean, they are the reigning national champion. So you want to shade that line a little bit there in that situation. But, you know, for Alabama here, I mean, Derrick Henry's gone, Kenyon Drake's gone, Jake Coker's gone, several losses on the offensive and defensive lines, all kinds of losses in the secondary as always. But the thing is, you know, where USC would have an athleticism advantage over other teams in similar situations at the start of the year, not so much against Alabama.
Exactly. I mean, you're talking about pretty much the one program, you know, of 128 FBS programs, the one that's able to one up USC in terms of just sheer talent, because you know, and that's the thing with SC was even when they had limited scholarships, they were still bringing in 4- and 5-star guys, which is not a whole lot of them. They've had a couple of years now where they've had their full allotment back and they've kind of replenished the ranks a little bit. But Alabama, it's just an absolute machine. So you're talking about replacing NFL caliber talent with NFL caliber talent, you know. The one spot where you might be able to exploit some weakness is that quarterback role. And, you know, is SC able to do that enough? I don't know. You know, I feel like they would have to force some turnovers, you know, get the ball in favorable field position in order to have a chance in this game.
I want to ask you a little bit more in detail, not just about this game, but with USC as a whole. So neutral site game in Arlington against Alabama. Week 2, they host Utah State. Week 3, they go to Stanford coming off of a bye, and then a short week to go to Utah on Friday night. We all know about those Utah Friday night games, great home field advantage there in the elevation, especially early in the season as guys are still trying to get you know, acclimated to the rigors of playing every week. USC could, I mean, it's conceivable they could start this season 1-3 with just that lone win over Utah State, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's very conceivable. That's just an absolutely brutal schedule to start. I think they have the most difficult schedule in college football by a pretty clear margin. UCLA's is pretty tough, and Stanford's is pretty tough. You know, LSU plays a pretty tough schedule. Actually, Alabama's is pretty challenging as well. But, you know, SC is clearly the most difficult schedule in college football. And that's a real tough way for Clay Helton to start, because a lot of people were lukewarm on the hire to begin with. And then you open up with Alabama, Stanford, and Utah. Plus, Utah State's no slouch there as your, you know, quote-unquote cupcake game. So, I mean, that's a murderer's row, man.
Team near and dear to your heart, Arizona Wildcats, they take on BYU. And this has been a very fascinating game to watch from a betting perspective here so far. This one at University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale. So, in a sense, it's a neutral site game, but you know, really, it should be more of a home game for Arizona's side. But Arizona opened a 1.5-point favorite out there in the market. Most books now showing a pick'em. The Greek and Five Dimes still showing Arizona a slight favorite here in this one. And I think that's really fascinating to see that BYU's been the side so far for the sharper players getting down, because you've got a very, very experienced Rich Rodriguez for Arizona against Kehlani Sitake for BYU, you know, a guy with a great defensive coordinator background, but a first-time head coach here.
Yes, and that's a really fascinating dynamic to me, because if you look at Kalani Sitake's defenses the last 2 years, 2014 he was at Utah, 2015 he was at Oregon State. Arizona's two most lopsided conference wins, 2014 was against Utah, 2015 was against Oregon State. So interesting dynamic there with that. I think that's something that might be worth keeping an eye on there. You know, Arizona is really loaded in terms of its experience. Now, whether or not that translates to anything, as a matter of fact, I believe it was Rich Rodriguez that made a joke a couple of years ago about returning starters are great, but if your returning starters aren't that good, then it doesn't matter that much. On offense, it's going to matter a lot, because I feel like they're going to be able to put up points with anybody. But defensively, they were abysmal last season. They gave up close to 50 a game in losses. So that's, you know, how much of an impact Marcel Yates has been able to have in terms of getting that defense up to speed is really going to kind of determine where Arizona's season goes. And, you know, in opening with that BYU team, that they can score a little bit. Tanner Mangum or Taysom Hill playing quarterback. Either way, BYU can score. So, you know, it's going to be a real huge test for Arizona. I think that's going to be a fascinating and very high-scoring game.
Well, and Jamal Williams coming back as well for BYU, and a guy that has been a very productive running back for them. That game is just full of intrigue. I mean, it's going to be pretty late at night. People are going to be pretty burned out, and it's going to be at the tail end of that USC-Alabama game. But in terms of games to watch, I think to find out about teams, that's one of the highest ones on the list for me, because we talked about the BYU dynamics with Sitake and then also with Arizona. I mean, if this is a team that gets any kind of defensive performance, they can be a live team here in the Pac-12 South, because the offense has upside to be that good.
Yeah, exactly. Arizona offensively, I think in the South, I think they might be the best offensive team this season. It's all about that defense though. I mean, that's where the question lies. You know, last season they were ravaged by injury. So, you know, having a little bit better luck on that front would certainly help them. Now, in terms of this particular game with BYU, you mentioned the, what seems like it would be a home field advantage, because, you know, you've got a ton of, Arizona alumni who live in Phoenix. Plus it's only from about, the University of Arizona's campus to University of Phoenix Stadium, only about 100 miles, but an interesting thing to keep in mind here, very high LDS population in the Phoenix Valley, in particular in the city of Mesa. So I think BYU is going to have a really strong contingent of fans there at that game. I think it'll be probably a pretty, I would say close to a 50-50 split in terms of fans.
Well, that's fascinating. I would have never thought of anything like that. So a very good tip there from Kyle Kensing for anybody interested in getting in on this game. I wanted to talk a little bit here about this politics stuff, because, you know, I know that we've had some talks about it before, and it's definitely something that, to an extent, fascinates both of us. I mean, this year, the election is, you know, I mean, there are a lot of adjectives I could use. There are a lot of words I could probably use in private that I can't say on the air about this election. But in terms of the way that things are shaking out, you know, you've got Hillary Clinton, -280 favorite at BetOnline, Donald Trump +260, better prices on Trump at other places like +333 at DSI. I mean, at this point in the game, I mean, what do you think is going to happen here with this?
Man, you know, I know we talked about it in February. I was one of those idiots who said, I think that Trump is novelty at this point. I think that he's got loud supporters who are just banging their pots and pans together. And at a certain point, the silent majority is going to rise up and Marco Rubio is going to beat him. Well, obviously, I know college football much better than I do the Republican Party or voters in general, because, boy, was I wrong about that one. I was reading 538 put out their first projection of the general election. They had Clinton at about 87% likelihood to win. And I've been a religious reader of 538 for its presidential odds going back to 08. That was – I remember following that really closely, and both 08 and 2012, they were right on the money. And 08 was they were way ahead of everybody else. I remember there was at one point when a lot of polls were really starting to kind of say McCain was a shoe-in. You know, there was one point around August or so where, you know, a lot of places like Quinnipiac, I think, were projecting him as a runaway winner. 538 said, no, Obama's going to win. He's going to win comfortably in terms of the Electoral College. So I think the fact that they're riding so heavily with Clinton historically would suggest that that's the case. But I've been wrong about Trump so much that, you know, it's fascinating to see because people are so vocally against him, including in his own party. But everybody keeps being wrong about him.
It's funny because I can hear the exasperation in your voice. Just trying to process all of this. And I mean, it's like we talked about earlier, you know, I mean, part of the problem here is that nobody really wants this position unless they're incredibly power hungry. Nobody wants this position. It's not, you know, the reputation of the office certainly isn't what it used to be. For those that are wondering, a -280 line at BetOnline implies a 73.68% probability that Hillary Clinton wins. And I would say that the odds of her winning are probably higher than that. So I think that at -280, it's a decent value play on Hillary. Again, I mean, who knows what could happen here when we actually get into debates? I mean, the things that Donald Trump is going to say in these debates, I hate politics Twitter. I hate debate Twitter. But, man, Twitter's going to be really entertaining the nights that we've got the Clinton-Trump debates.
It'll be unbelievable. And you mentioned, like, why would somebody run for office? And they'd have to be really power hungry. I tend to think that that's the case for Clinton, who has wanted this job for years and years and years now, believes that she was entitled to it in 08, you know, was patiently biding her time. For her, I think that she wants office because she is that kind of person. I have been of the opinion, and I could be completely wrong here, but I've been of the opinion, and I'm still of the opinion, that Trump was running as a paid advertisement to sell shit, pardon my language, to sell products. And I feel like that he is saying increasingly insane things for the sole purpose of trying to lose, and it only gains him more support. So I think that once the debate rolls around, he's going to start just dropping the most insane – you know, I cuss – just now, which I never do on air. My apologies for that. It's because I'm so dumbfounded by it that I feel like he's probably going to start cussing with a live mic in front of him at the debates, and it'll probably gain him points in the polls.
You know what? It's weird. I kind of wonder, though, and maybe this is just me being kind of a conspiracy theorist about it. Does this guy really have that much support, or is it just that the media, you know, wants to sensationalize this whole thing? So, you know, they're paying so much attention to Donald Trump. I mean, if anyone was paying attention to anything in Hillary's past, this may be somewhat of a closer race, but Trump is just that outlandish, that ludicrous, that the media has been infatuated with him. And you and I talked about this in the past, and I've referenced it here on the show before. The amount of free advertising for his own brands and for this campaign that has been given to him by the news networks is probably the sole reason that this guy is still in this thing and will be on the ballot in November.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think in terms of his actual support, if you look at some of the primaries he won, and the fact that the primaries are staggered so much, you know, obviously he's going to have larger margins of victory once guys start falling out of the race. But when it was still a competitive race, he wasn't winning high percentages of voters. You know, he had his real dug-in supporters who I think was, you know, intentionally in terms of the long run, might be what he's trying to do is build up a real loyal consumer base of people. But in terms of the actual percentages and the number of voters he was getting, it really wasn't that high. And I agree with you, especially television media really has a tendency to latch on to that easy, you know, what's going to make somebody tune in or stick around for the commercials with a 3-second spot? Hey, we've got an orange Oompa Loompa who's saying racist stuff. I mean, that's going to make you stick around for the commercial break and appease advertisers. So, you know, it's entirely possible that's the reason that he's on the ballot in November.
The revisionist history of this entire presidential cycle, you know, things that are written in, I mean, there'll be something written probably immediately after Inauguration Day, but the stuff that's written 10, 20, 30 years down the line, if all of us are lucky enough to see it, it's going to be incredible. I mean, this thing legitimately feels like a Netflix show come to real life.
It really does. And it's fascinating because no matter what you think of Clinton and some of the stuff in her, if you were to look at this just from the purely pragmatic standpoint of, okay, one person who's running for office has all this experience where they've been Secretary of State and they've been a senator and that sort of thing, running against a guy who, you know, got clotheslined by Vince McMahon at WrestleMania and, you know, is involved in 500 lawsuits simultaneously. It's insanity, but, you know, it really is kind of like a Netflix series. It's so unbelievable. It really is, you know, reality stranger than fiction.
Let's see if we can get this back on the rails, you know, for our demographic here. It's interested in betting. Have you done any thinking about either vice presidential nominee?
I have a little bit just because some of the names that are coming up initially on both sides, I'm sitting there thinking this makes no sense from a standpoint of actually trying to win the election. You know, with Clinton, I know people are pushing Warren really hard, which I can understand why. She's very charismatic. And I feel like she probably appeals to a certain base within the Democratic Party that might feel a little disenfranchised right now. But I think that having a ticket of two women, I don't think that the country is quite ready for that sort of thing yet. So to me, the fact that that's coming up as the top name right now for Clinton, I'm a little surprised by. And then in terms of Trump, today I'd read a report that he's seriously considering Chris Christie, which it's too fitting. It's too fitting. I feel like he would have him up there, stumping for Donald at events, and Trump would start cutting promos on him and making fun of him and calling him fat in front of people. You know, it's almost like that situation of a group of friends that keeps around one person who's the hand grenade as you were. It's insane. You know, I don't think that it's going to be an establishment person like Marco Rubio. But I'm interested to see if a name comes out of left field, which, given the direction of this election, I'm sure that that's where the VP pick is going to be, is out of left field.
On the Democratic side, Elizabeth Warren, the second favorite at 4-1 at BetOnline. Tim Kaine, the favorite, +110. Julian Castro also up there, +500. Then a lot of other people, 12-1 or higher.
Tim Kaine seems like the logical, safe choice to me.
I mean, you got guys like Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders at 16-1. I think that there's no way that happens, but you know, who knows what? I mean, there's, I don't know. Then again, you expect the unexpected here with this election cycle. But on the Republican side, Jeff Sessions +300, Newt Gingrich +300, John Kasich +450. I don't really think that Kasich is going to bark up that tree when he's, you know, actually gotten a little bit of momentum within the Republican Party to, you know, be able to get some sort of decent ranking position, depending on what he does next, you know, after his stint as governor of Ohio. But Chris Christie up there at +700. So seems like Christie's probably the value pick. But again, I mean, who knows? Donald Trump could come out and say that, you know, a porn star is going to be vice president. It wouldn't surprise anybody.
Yeah, listen, I mean, you know, Mike Tyson is of age that he would qualify. I don't know if he can be a convicted felon and hold that level of office, but Mike Ditka, maybe. I know at one point the Illinois Republican Party was recruiting him to run against Barack Obama for the Senate seat, so you never know.
You know, if we got Mike Ditka in there, at least SNL would have to bring back Bill Swirsky and all those guys. So at least we'd get that out of it, right? The super fans.
Yeah, I think that the possibilities for that are phenomenal. I think Ditka would be an awesome choice from a purely entertainment standpoint.
And sad to say, I mean, we're talking about one of the highest offices in the world, and this election's basically nothing more than an entertainment standpoint. So, you know, it is what it is. But speaking of an entertainment standpoint, I've been having this discussion with a few people here recently, so I want to get your take on it. And I knew that this conversation would really excite you, so I think it's a good thing to end on. If Dwayne The Rock Johnson announced that he was running a presidential bid as an independent and went all the way through to November, was on the ballot, what percentage of the popular vote do you think he would get?
Popular vote. I think he would probably get, I'm going to say 15%. Yeah, I'm going to go 15%. I think if he ran as an independent, he would get 15% of the national popular vote, and I think he would win a few states. I think
isn't
he would fare better.
Isn't that incredible?
I think he would fare better than Gary Johnson is going to in this election, and I think Gary Johnson's going to do very well for a third-party candidate. But I think The Rock would get 15%, and I could see him winning. I could see him doing well in Florida, if not outright winning Florida. And I think that he could win, let's say, like
Hawaii.
Yeah, I think he could win Hawaii. I think he absolutely could win in Hawaii. Yeah, I think The Rock would do great as an independent.
I mean, because, you know, BuzzFeed's had that article, and a couple other places have had that article, you know, just kind of, I would say somewhat facetiously throwing it out there, but at the same time, I mean, this is a guy that, you know, has developed a worldwide brand, you know, has some business interests that he has had success with. He's, of course, exceptionally charismatic. You know, I mean, what other countries would F with The Rock?
Yeah, and yeah, that's a great point, because I think if a country was trying to get tough with The Rock, you would cut an epic Rock promo promising to lay the smack down on their Rudy Poo candy asses. So I think that would certainly help in terms of international diplomacy. And if I remember correctly, I could be wrong on this. He might've been invited and not actually attended, but if memory serves, I think he actually spoke at the 2000 GOP National Convention. I could be wrong on that, but I seem to remember that being the case.
Okay. Well, then that's a separate question altogether. If he latched on to a party and ran, you know, obviously he can't really do that now because they're going to nominate someone at the convention and all that. But if he were ever to run from a major party, I mean, wouldn't we have President Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
I think it's entirely possible. And here's the thing that I think would work about it. Not only is he a celebrity, not only is he charismatic, he's an intelligent guy. He's done well in business. But I mentioned him speaking at or being invited to speak. I can't remember which it was, the GOP convention. He's politically very centrist. He's liberal in terms of social things, and I think pretty conservative in terms of business. I think he would appeal to a sort of disenfranchised middle in the country and do really well with that kind of independent swing voter. So I really think that The Rock, now that you bring this up, I really do think that President Rock isn't that outlandish.
It's incredible to think that. I mean, it's not a reflection of him. I mean, if he was running this year, I'm not going to lie, I would vote for him. But, you know, the fact that we are at that point where we're talking about a college football player from the University of Miami turned professional wrestler as our possible president, I mean, it's remarkable to think about. And I'm glad that you're the exact person I'd want to have this discussion with, because I know that you're very, very into, at least, you know, used to be very into the wrestling scene, and you know, you're kind of an encyclopedia when it comes to that. So I had to make sure that I brought that into today's segment.
Well, there's no used to about it. I still watch old matches. I'm not so up to date on the newer stuff, But I certainly watch the old stuff on WWE Network.
Well, I think this is a good way to wrap up a Friday with something very lighthearted here as we head into holiday weekend. Kyle Kensing, CFBHuddle.com. What's going on over there right now at the website?
Yeah, just gearing up for the season. You know, with being the off season, been kind of talking some not as serious stuff of late. I did a breakdown on the ill-fated ESPN Who's Now campaign of 2007. I'd recommend you check that out because that I got pretty violent with my rhetoric in that one. But we'll also be kind of gearing it up a little bit more serious about college football now that we're getting towards media days and the start of the season.
Well, that's at Kensing and the number 45 on Twitter. Kyle Kensing, appreciate your time as always, man. Thanks a lot. Hopefully we'll talk to you again real soon.
Absolutely. Always my pleasure.
Well, as I said, that's a really fun segment there with Kyle Kensing. I thought it was a great way to wrap it up. He sent me a Twitter DM right after we finished recording that and said that the Rock topic was awesome. And it certainly was. So you know, hopefully you enjoyed it as much as we did. And again, as I said, I think that's a really good way to wrap up this week here on Bang the Book Radio. So again, keep in mind the scheduling changes that we're going to have. No show coming up on Monday. No show on Tuesday. Again, if I get the time here on this holiday weekend to throw together some Bettors Box thoughts, I will do that for you. In fact, I should try to do that. So we'll see if I can come up, even if it's a little bit of a shortened version. But we'll have live broadcasts on Wednesday and Thursday of next week. Another Bettors Box on Friday. Then we'll be dark for the All-Star break. So it'll give all of us a chance. Take a little bit of a breather and step away because sometimes, you know, you just need to do that. But that'll do it for us. You know, thank you very much for listening, everybody. Have a happy, smart, and safe 4th of July weekend. Nobody out there pull a Jason Pierre-Paul, and I'll talk to you again next week.